You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, between the Sandy Hook massacre just under a decade ago and this week's shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, not much has changed when it comes to gun laws. After an 18-year-old killed 19 children and two teachers with an AR-15-style weapon, some members of the U.S. Senate say they are working to negotiate something that they can agree on. This comes as the NRA meets in Texas now and through the weekend amid protests at the meeting site. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you believe is the answer to preventing mass shootings? Do you think we need more or fewer guns to combat gun violence? Are you a teacher or a parent with kids in school? What are you thinking about right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Eric Rubin is an assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, despite some high-profile mass shootings over the last bunch of years and an uptick in less high-profile shootings in cities around the country, it doesn't seem like anywhere there's been a lot in the way of changes of gun laws. What have you seen going on over the last decade?
Well, look, at the federal level, there hasn't been any major gun control laws passed since the 1990s. You'd have to go back a quarter century. And in the interim, you've got everything from Columbine to this week's shooting that has happened. So the federal government has been gridlocked on meaningful gun regulation. But most gun regulation, historically and over the past decade or two, is at the state and local level. And we have seen some changes in state and local gun laws. In fact, some states, in the wake of mass shootings, tend to loosen their gun regulations to allow more people to carry guns and to obtain different types of more lethal weapons. Other states, typically Democratic-led states, have tried to respond to the mass shootings by tightening gun restrictions. So after Sandy Hook, for instance, New York State passed the SAFE Act, Connecticut acted, other states acted as well, to limit the ability of people to get so-called assault rifles and large capacity magazines and to require universal background checks and the like. But that has not been the universal approach. So we have a patchwork of state laws now and a patchwork of approaches following these mass shootings.
And those state and local laws are constrained by what the U.S. Supreme Court says is or isn't constitutional. In fairly recent American history, the Supreme Court established that gun ownership is an individual right. This was a pretty big change, right, compared to how courts had ruled for the first couple hundred years.
Yeah, and you're referring to the case in 2008 called District of Columbia v. Heller. And so in that case, the plaintiff, Dick Heller, wanted to have a handgun in his home, unrelated to a militia service. He wanted to have it for self-defense. And Washington, D.C. had a ban on the possession of handguns in the home. And the Supreme Court in that case, for the first time in over 200 years, said that the Second Amendment, which provides a well-regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, protects not a militia-related right, but a private right related to individual private self-defense from criminals and the like. That case was the first time a federal appellate court had ever in the history of the United States struck down a gun law on Second Amendment grounds. So it was a landmark case, and it's opened the door to a heck of a lot of litigation. In fact, there's one Supreme Court case that is pending right now that could further inhibit the ability of governments to regulate firearms.
I wanted to ask you about that case next, coming out of, I think, New York State.
Right. So this case, it's called Bruin, it's the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin, involves a restriction on carrying handguns in public. Heller, that 2008 case, held that you have a right to have a handgun in your home for self-defense if you're not otherwise disqualified. But the case didn't deal with the ability of carrying handguns in public, where, of course, guns can present externalities and problems for other people. This case addresses that issue. In New York State and other states, in order to get a permit to carry a concealed handgun, you have to show good cause or proper cause. And what that means in eight states that have these policies is that you have to show a heightened need for self-defense. something that separates you from the general public. Saying that you just have a generalizable fear that a stranger might attack you is not enough to get a concealed carry permit in New York. So the plaintiffs in that case didn't have any special security needs that separated them from the general public. And as a result, they did not get an unrestricted permit. Rather, they got permits to carry handguns to and from work and in certain other unpopulated places. And they're saying that that policy violates their Second Amendment rights. And after oral arguments, it seemed like the conservative majority on the Supreme Court right now agrees. And if they were to strike that down, this would be a significant divergence from the consensus view in the lower federal courts, which have by and large upheld these policies. New York's policy, for example, goes back over a century.
What, of course, it depends on how the Supreme Court rules, even if they do overturn this law. What are other laws then that might be challenged under a ruling overturning that law in New York?
Right. And Rob, I think that you hit the nail on the head. A lot depends on how the Supreme Court issues its ruling. So assuming that the majority of the justices are going to strike down New York's law, that will have or at least this proper cause component of New York's law, that will have immediate next day effects for a quarter of Americans who live in places where you have to show this height and self-defense need in order to get carry a handgun in public. Those places can expect more people carrying handguns in public. And that alone has been associated in the research with an uptick in aggregate violent crime. So that is one thing that people can expect in those places. The data suggests that the increase in other places that have loosened their public carry restrictions can be in the range of 10 to 15% uptick in certain violent crimes. So those places will try to compensate with new laws. But it's also possible the Supreme Court says, look, it's unconstitutional to even require a license to carry a handgun in public. In other words, the permitless carry movement that we're seeing across the country right now is correct about the fact that that is the constitutional standard. Now, I would be surprised if the Supreme Court goes that far, but if they did, that would affect a lot more states' laws. And there's another thing that's at issue in this case that I think is merits attention, which is that the plaintiffs and others in the case are asking the Supreme Court to declare the overall methodology that the lower courts are applying in these cases to be the improper methodology. And instead, they want the Supreme Court to say that in Second Amendment challenges, the constitutionality of a law depends solely on history and tradition, such as the history of gun regulation at the time that the Second Amendment was enacted in 1791, or maybe when the 14th Amendment was enacted in 1868, and it does not care about modern gun violence and modern solutions to modern gun violence. And if that is something that the Supreme Court does, if it says that that is the metric for determining the constitutionality of gun laws, the impact will be much broader than just public carry. In fact, it would affect all weapons laws that have been challenged in the years since Heller. Courts have overwhelmingly upheld gun regulation, largely by virtue of the fact that they determine that gun regulations that are being challenged sufficiently further an important public interest in stopping gun violence today, modern gun violence. If the court makes this methodological change, however, it would reopen litigation across issues. So we'll see new challenges to so-called assault weapon bans, large capacity magazine restrictions on who can have a gun, such as whether or not felon in possession laws are unconstitutional, or laws seeking to keep firearms away from the mentally ill. The whole range of firearms laws and knife laws and all other weapons laws would be reopened to constitutional challenge.
We're talking to Eric Rubin, assistant professor of law at Southern Methodist University, who studies Second Amendment rights, looking at the status of gun laws in the United States, how they may or may not change in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see changes in gun regulations in one direction or another? Are you a parent worried about sending your kid to school after this week and previous school shootings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Eric Rubin from Southern Methodist University, looking at gun laws and gun reform in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, would you like to see changed? 800-642-1234. Jeremy joins us now in Superior. Jeremy, hello.
Hi, thank you. Every time something like a horrible tragedy like this happens, and it has to involve a firearm, the same thing keeps, same narrative keeps being brought up. Blaming the object, blaming the tool, blaming the gun. It is absolutely ludicrous that this keeps happening, how we're blaming an object for the actions of an individual. And I'm going to use an analogy that I've used quite a bit. If a contractor comes to your home, installs a brand new door, and the door is crooked, do you blame the contractor's hammer, or do you blame the contractor himself?
Well, Jeremy, I mean, let me ask you, Jeremy, automatic weapons in the country are illegal, almost completely illegal, because people see them as a tool that allows too much lethality. Is there a limit for you for how lethal a tool could be between automatic weapons, semi-automatic weapons, where we say maybe that tool lets that bad person do too much damage?
Well, for one, and like you said, fully automatic weapons are illegal in the United States. Semi-automatic weapon is a very, very common weapon and tool used for hunting, sport shooting. I own multiple myself. Never has one of my guns gone off on its own or shot at in anybody's direction. And if anything happens, the trigger needs to be pulled by an individual. And I'm sorry, mental health is the number one issue in the entire debate. It's not guns.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Mental health often not involved in these shootings, Eric. But to his point, do we blame the tool or the person?
Look, I mean, obviously there's not just one thing here, but it's hard to discount the increased lethality of firearms. One of the ironies about the argument that Jeremy was raising is that a lot of gun rights advocates would balk at the suggestion that they should just defend themselves with a knife or with a taser or without any weapon whatsoever. They insist that the firearm itself enables them to better protect themselves. And the same thing happens on the flip side. Firearms are more lethal than other types of weapons. They intensify violence. And the data backs this up. So, one of the quips you might think about is there's no such thing as a drive-by knifing, right? You can use a gun to shoot somebody at distance. If a gun is used in an assault, it is likely to be more lethal than if a different weapon is used. So yeah, of course, firearms don't shoot themselves. They require the efforts of the shooter as well. But if you have somebody with mental health issues, as Jeremy said, or somebody who is intent on violence, they're going to most likely be more lethal if they can get their hands on a gun, and a gun that can dispel more bullets faster than if they can't. And so I think that's one of the logics between some of the incremental changes that are suggested in terms of gun regulation. Are they going to solve gun violence? No. But would they incrementally perhaps make improvements? I think that is where the debate really is.
Jeremy, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Jim now in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I think it's important that people maintain the ability to defend themselves. There's not often spoken of, but there's a couple million times a year, it's pretty well documented, that violent crimes are prohibited by private ownership of firearms. And the canard about large capacity magazines is also apparent in cases like the elderly gentleman who heard people breaking into his home and defended himself with a 30-round magazine against four armed individuals, each with 15-round magazines in their pistols.
Jim, thanks for the call. Defensive gun use often cited, Eric, as an argument against gun law changes.
Yeah, so this is obviously one of the big public policy issues that is going on right now, is that firearms are used defensively. Of course, there are anecdotes of that. Now, I think that a lot of times the number of times and the proportion of self-defense incidents that involve a firearm is exaggerated. The National Crime Victimization Survey, which is the best data that we have on this, suggests that less than 1% of self-defense incidents involve the defensive use of a firearm. As many defensive incidents, according to that survey, involve weapons other than firearms, so think knives and the like. And then well over 90% of self-defense incidents don't involve a weapon at all. But it is true that firearms can be used defensively, just like they can be used offensively. To Jim's point about the fact that if you are attacked by, you know, multiple people who are carrying automatic weapons, would you want to have the firepower to defend against those people? Sure, there's some intuitive value to that, but I think that those types of attacks are less likely. And the question in terms of policy is that you're not going to have a perfect solution to providing people with self-defense in every single situation. You're not going to have the perfect solution to preventing gun violence. You have to weigh the pros and the cons of these different policy solutions. And that ultimately leaves a lot of people dissatisfied.
Thanks for the call. Randy joins us now in Ripon. Randy, hello.
Hi. I just want to point out, I served in the military. I qualified as a marksman. And it's one thing to shoot at a target when you're calm, cool, and relaxed. And I've had friends and acquaintances that carry guns, pistols. And one thing I point out to them, I say, are you fully prepared to pull that gun out and mistakenly kill an innocent person or be mistaken for the bad guy by the authorities? Because the bad guy isn't wearing a sign saying, hey, I'm the bad guy, shoot me. And there could be another fellow doing the same thing you're doing. This is all really naive, thinking you can just whip out a gun and start blasting away and be a hero, because it's real easy to miss when your adrenaline's pumping. That's all I got to say.
Randy, thanks for sharing your experience there. Eric, what do you think?
No, of course. I mean, some of the data involving police shootings is somewhat stark in that police miss their targets a lot and they have to train repeatedly. And I think that this also brings up another policy that's at issue right now, and it's being debated in Wisconsin and other places, is whether or not we should remove the permitting requirement before you can carry a concealed weapon altogether. And one of the, and this is, you know, called by some advocates for it constitutional carry, it's permitless carry. And one of the things that you give up if you make that change is to get the permit. Most places require you to go through some sort of gun training, some live shooting. And if you remove that, you also remove the requirement that people actually train with their guns. And to Randy's point, even if people are trained, you still miss a lot. And it's a consideration, I think, that should be on the table as we're debating permitless carry.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Eric Rubin, law professor at Southern Methodist University, looking at the politics and law of gun control in the United States. Eric, I don't want to let the time get passed without visiting the U.S. Senate. We talked some about the courts. There is talk of at least some kind of negotiation among Democrats and Republicans to do something, TBD, right now. What kind of things are you watching for in the U.S. Senate?
You know, I mentioned this before, there hasn't been any significant gun safety regulation at the federal level for a quarter century. Anything that comes out of the Senate would be a big deal because of that. Though I imagine anything would be disappointing to a lot of gun safety advocates. And it's unclear what exactly is on the table. One of the policies that might have legs is a measure to incentivize states that have not already adopted red flag laws, which permit a family member or a law enforcement or in some places school administrators to petition to remove guns from somebody who is showing an acute threat to themselves or to others. One of the policies would incentivize states to adopt those reforms. 19 states have already done it, including plus the District of Columbia. And why that might have legs, especially amongst Republican caucus that tends to oppose any restrictions on firearm possession, is that the measure wouldn't actually mandate anything. It would leave it up to individual states and provide funding for the states themselves to decide whether or not to implement these policies. So it would shift the debate back to the states. In some places, like Oklahoma, have already made clear that they would not adopt this measure. Oklahoma has recently passed an anti-red flag law. So that's one of that's the sort of thing that I'm watching for. It would be promising if there could be some bipartisan agreement on gun regulation, but most likely it wouldn't be strong regulation that you'd see coming out of the Senate.
And briefly, Eric, we're hearing a lot of different things from the police in this particular horrific shooting. One sentiment is that they felt like they were outgunned by the perpetrator with an AR-15 platform rifle. Do you see the police being a factor in limiting potentially the kinds of guns that are available in just our last few moments?
Yeah. So, I mean, police have consistently come out against various legislation that loosens gun restrictions for this very reason. And what you saw about the police feeling outgunned in this case, you also saw in Charlottesville, if you recall the protests. There, police felt that the armed protesters outgunned them. You see this in other places, in Dallas here, in fact. In Dallas, the shooting that happened in downtown Dallas, police felt outgunned. And this is, I think, something to think about when we consider the types of weapons that individuals have.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Eric Rubin, assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University, fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, studying Second Amendment rights. He's with us today to talk about lack of changes in federal gun laws despite a string of mass shootings over the years. Coming up Monday on Central Time, they are the social media of their day, and you could still use them to send unique messages. We'll check out the history of the postcard. And our skills and talents may change as we get older. That can be good news. We'll talk to the author of the new book, From Strength to Strength. That and more Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, it's Mental Health Awareness Month. We'll find out why there's still a lot of stigma surrounding schizophrenia and other disorders that cause psychosis. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, when a recipe only calls for a little bit of one ingredient, what do you do with all those extras that are left over? On Food Friday, we talk to the author of the new cookbook, To the Last Bite, and find out how to make the most out of all those ingredients without wasting stuff. First, it's National Mental Health Awareness Month. Over the past few decades, research shows that stigma towards some common mental illnesses like depression and anxiety disorders has decreased drastically. But people who have mental illnesses that cause psychosis, things like schizophrenia, are rarely included in the conversation. People with psychotic symptoms like hallucinations or delusions can still face stereotyping and discrimination. A 2013 study from the National Institutes of Health found more negative stereotypes and less willingness to help for people labeled as at risk for schizophrenia than for non-psychotic mental health disorders like depression and anxiety. We're learning about psychosis and why it still carries that stigma, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one experienced one of the different kinds of psychosis? What were your interactions with medical and psychiatric care like? What do you think people get wrong about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Raquel Meshulam-Gately is an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and a licensed clinical psychologist. She's director of neuropsychology research and the Consumer Advisory Board at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Raquel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me to join your show. I'm really delighted to be here. And I just want to note that I am especially honored to be included in the show with your next guest, Cindy Hodge from the Wildflower Alliance. I know that their work was just featured in a New York Times Magazine article last week, and I am so impressed with the incredibly important and valuable work that they do.
Now, I just mentioned the word psychosis a couple times. Can you give us kind of a working definition for our conversation? What do we mean by psychosis?
Sure. Well, first, let me say that psychosis is a set of symptoms, not a diagnosis. So it is not the same thing as a diagnosis like schizophrenia, although schizophrenia is one of several conditions in which psychotic symptoms are a primary feature. So psychosis is a set of symptoms referring to a loss of contact with reality or difficulty telling what's real from what is not. The symptoms can also make it harder for a person to think clearly, to communicate, relate to others, and to feel emotions. A person can experience psychosis for numerous reasons, such as in the context of drug use, medical issues like seizures or sleep deprivation, postpartum, traumatic stress, grief, medical treatments, dementia, or a psychiatric condition such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or depression. So when someone seeks help for psychotic symptoms, so many factors are considered, such as their specific symptoms, when they started, the severity, extent of distress and impact, and the potential causes and influences. And I'll also note that psychosis is a lot more common than people tend to think. Symptoms fall on a continuum based on severity, frequency, and impact, just like depression and anxiety or any other condition for that matter. And we all fall somewhere on the spectrum, which can fluctuate over time or in different circumstances. I think we can all think of times when maybe because we didn't sleep well, we were under the influence of a substance, we experienced a lot of stress one day, or a variety of other reasons, we may have noticed that our thoughts or perceptions weren't as clear as they typically are. So because of that, we often avoid using the terms normal or abnormal, but rather familiar versus distressing. And just one last important point I want to make is that early intervention can really help to promote recovery and reduce disability. We know that treatment delays often lead to poorer outcomes. And there's now more help than ever for people experiencing signs of serious mental illnesses. Early recognition and intervention can make a real difference for people.
I want to get to that stigma issue. I got to say, in the popular culture landscape I grew up in, if I saw, say, a TV show or movie with somebody identified with schizophrenia or hearing voices, if it was a comedy, it was played for laughs. It wasn't a comedy. The person was portrayed as very dangerous. And that's what I grew up knowing, quote unquote, about these conditions. Can you talk about the damage that might do?
Absolutely. And you're right. There has long been an association between schizophrenia and dangerousness, as well as a lot of other negative misperceptions and misunderstandings about the conditions. And those attitudes really negatively impact upon the lives of people living with the condition. They're linked to less social interaction, lower levels of recovery and vocational functioning and quality of life. Plus, because of that stigma, people who have the condition aren't willing to talk about it as much. They aren't willing to seek out care for it as frequently. Their family members by association also will feel shame and often won't seek out care for their loved ones. And sometimes clinicians are not willing to disclose a diagnosis of psychosis to patients or schizophrenia because of that negative association with it. So it can do a lot of damage. And I think even the term just over time has been so abused in the media and just in our day-to-day language. I mean, it's often used as an adjective to describe any kind of erratic behavior, you know, whether it be referring to the government, financial market, sports. I mean, the list can go on and on. So I think that's really confused people about what schizophrenia is.
We're talking to Raquel Meshulam-Gately from Harvard Medical School, looking at some of the different conditions that cause psychosis, schizophrenia included in that, and other psychological conditions. You can join in if you have a story you'd be willing to share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Raquel, you mentioned the value of early treatment. So suppose somebody recognizes this in themselves or a family member, overcomes that stigma, goes to seek treatment, gets a clinician who's ready to work with them. What kind of things are out there that can help?
Right. Well, we know the best kind of treatments out there, especially for the early phases of psychosis, are coordinated specialty care models. And there's, I'll just speak of Massachusetts, there's numerous clinics available here where they offer a variety of services, not just medication, but different types of psychosocial interventions. Peer support is often included, family-based treatments. So it's a really integrated, comprehensive approach to trying to help with those early symptoms of psychosis. And we do know, again, that the earlier you intervene in these conditions, the better the outcomes are. So we really encourage that. And I'll just say too that I'm involved with an initiative within Massachusetts called the Massachusetts Psychosis Network for Early Treatment. And within that, we provide training and technical assistance to providers across the state to really try to link them up with the best practices and models for helping people with psychosis.
Now, for someone who is interacting with someone, maybe a loved one, maybe a patient, and that loved one or patient says, "Yeah, I'm hearing things that I think aren't there," or other things that might be signs of psychosis of one form or another. Can you talk about the best ways to respond, you know, not with that initial maybe fear or stigma, but with compassion in a way that's going to help somebody get help?
Right. I am so glad that you mentioned that, because responding in a way that shows compassion is one of the most important tools for helping people who are experiencing psychosis, so that the focus is really on understanding versus fixing, and really open connection building types of questions that show real genuine empathy and curiosity versus questions or statements that sound prescriptive or judgmental. And I think regardless of whether you have psychosis or not, everybody wants to be treated that way. I think the same rules apply to speaking to someone with psychosis as it would for anyone else experiencing distress. That connection, that empathy, the non-judgmental kinds of ways of speaking are just so incredibly important.
Let's bring on a caller. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So my question is, with like a psychosis brought on by something like PTSD from war or some other traumatic event, I have heard studies recently that they're talking about using psilocybin mushrooms, like magic mushrooms, to basically induce the psychosis to help resolve the original PTSD psychosis issue. And I guess I was just wondering the doctor's thoughts on that juxtaposition between using something that creates a psychosis to solve the psychosis.
Marcus, thanks for that call. Raquel, I feel like I've seen headlines about this again and again. Is there research going on that says this could be a positive step?
I have to say that I'm not aware of a lot of research that's been done in that area yet. Kind of like you said, there's certainly been a lot of headlines about it, but whether there's a strong evidence base behind that, it seems like the jury is still out, and that, you know, we need more research to really understand whether that can be beneficial for people in the long term.
Thanks for the call, Marcus. And Raquel, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, I'm delighted. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Raquel Meshulam-Gately, assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, licensed clinical psychologist. She's director of neuropsychology research and the Consumer Advisory Board at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. We're talking about psychosis, the stigma around it, possible treatments, and coming up, we're going to hear about a support group and the Hearing Voices movement. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be talking about peer-to-peer support for psychosis. What do you want to know about that? Have you done that yourself? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about breaking the stigma surrounding schizophrenia and other conditions that can cause psychosis. A grassroots campaign called the Hearing Voices Movement is working to empower people who experience psychosis to talk about it openly and get support from their peers. The Hearing Voices Movement aims to validate the experiences of people with psychosis, provide coping mechanisms, and eliminate shame. Well, listen to some people who've taken part in the Hearing Voices movement talk about their experiences. This is from a documentary called Beyond Possible, How the Hearing Voices Approach Transforms Lives.
My life changed dramatically because the voices that used to taunt me all the time, used to beat me up, they don't do that anymore. Because the simple fact I'm sharing my experience with other people, what I went through with my voices.
A big thing for me was knowing that I wasn't alone. Not being judged, a place that I could talk freely, not worrying about, am I going to end up in the hospital?
It's given me clarity, that's given me more stability, more confidence. I was shy, now I can speak out loud. It's really given me back my sense of self.
There's been limited research on the Hearing Voices approach, but some early research has shown promising signs. Cindy Hadge is lead trainer at the Wildflower Alliance, a group that offers peer-to-peer support for people who experience voices, visions, unusual beliefs, and extreme states. Cindy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I understand you've been a member of Hearing Voices support groups yourself. Could you share some of your personal experience and how it's worked for you?
Absolutely. I was at a point in my life where I was on Thorazine, and I was contemplating ending my life. I had tried very hard to use the traditional approaches to navigating the experience, and it really wasn't working for me. And I thought about peer support, because I had an experience with a 12-step peer support really helping me, and I just typed in mental health peer support, and I found out I lived within walking distance of one of the only groups at the time, the only Hearing Voices group in the United States. And in going to that group, instead of being a patient or mentally ill, people mirrored back strength to me. And I got to hear other people who are given the same diagnosis, and they were creating lives that they wanted to live. And in that moment, I thought, you know, maybe that's possible for me too.
Can you talk about what you talk about when you get together with people in a Hearing Voices support group?
Well, we have the freedom to talk about whatever we want to talk about. But for an example, at one time I had a huge fear, and it was making it hard to sleep at night. I kept having this fear that somebody would enter my apartment. And when I went to the group, I talked about the fear. They didn't say, oh, you're being silly, or don't worry. They asked me questions about the fear, and we narrowed it down to I had a fear that I would wake up to someone standing over my bed. And as a group, we brainstormed what to do, and I put pots and pans on my stairs so that I would be awake before, you know, anybody would be able to come in. And what happened was I was able to get sleep, you know, calm down, and I realized what had activated that fear in me, that I had seen a violent act outside my apartment that, unconsciously reminded me of a time in my past where my experience was that I would wake up as a kid to somebody standing over my bed. So it was really neat to have people be curious about the context of my experience.
That sounds, at root, like really empowering, like you were... You and the other people in the group took charge and figured out, brainstormed problems or solutions to your problem instead of somebody coming and solving it for you. How big a part of this peer-to-peer concept is that?
Well, it's truly about sharing experience, strength, and hope, and that people do develop strategies to deal for these unusual experiences, and they can learn from each other. Not that any one person has the right answer or somebody else, but to say there are options, there are things that I can do. They really encouraged me to become the expert of my experience, Like, when does that voice come? Does it come in relationship to anything? Have you gotten messages like that at another point in your life? How do you feel about those messages? Can you, you know, set kind of some kind of limits with those messages, with those voices? How do you understand them? How do you make meaning of them? And those are questions that I had not received in the traditional mental health system. You know, in the traditional system, I was simply told, we need to adjust your medication. That would be the response.
What do you wish people who don't experience these things, what do you wish that that they knew about what you go through and how you experience it?
Well, just, you know, you may not have ever had a voice yelling at you, but I bet you you've had somebody yell at you. Right?
Sure.
And so can you imagine how that feels? And so when somebody tells you, you know, I have a voice yelling at me, it's really not helpful to say, oh, just ignore it. It's not real. Instead, it might be helpful to say, that sounds really hard. I wouldn't like it if somebody was yelling at me. You know, those are the things that are helpful to acknowledge that even if you're not sharing the experience that person is having, they are really having that experience.
If somebody out there is listening right now and saying, wow, this is me or this is my loved one, how do people seek out this kind of peer-to-peer support experience?
And so they can definitely reach out to the Wildflower Alliance, and I'm hoping that there's a way that you share our website. And there are lots of Hearing Voices groups all over the U.S., and we also have a number of family and friends groups. So people come in and they say, you know, I want to support my loved one. And we'll talk about, you know, how do they take care of their own selves? How do they deal with their own fear? You were talking about stigma earlier, and, you know, what do you, you know, a lot of times people, it's not the person hearing the voices that is in crisis. Sometimes it's the family member who's in crisis because they so much want to fix it, end it, cure it, solve it in a moment. And so anyways, family members need support too. And we encourage family members to actually show curiosity instead of fear and to show, you know, a faith in their loved one. You know, I believe in you. I love you. You know, I hope for good things for you versus I'm afraid of you and we got to get you to the hospital.
We've got a link up to a Dane County Hearing Voices support group at WPR.org/Central Time. We'll get one up there, by the way, for the Wildflower Alliance as well. We heard at the outset, Cindy, in that documentary, some people with, I think, amazing stories to share. What we heard your story. What do you hear from other people who have also joined peer-to-peer support about how it's changed the way they live their lives?
Because what's been really helpful, I think, for a lot of people is to find out they're not alone and that other people can navigate this and maybe they can too. That we, as I said earlier, we really shift the focus to, you know, what are your strengths and what do you want to do? And for once, you know, people aren't trying to tell other people what to do. It's more like, what would you like to do and how can we support you in that? And just building people up instead of marginalizing them with labels and knowing that there's so many more tools to put in your toolbox than a psychiatric drug. You know, there's a place for that, or people get to decide how those work in your life. But there's also all these other things that you can do, some of which are clinical and some of them are, you know, peer support based.
And just our last half minute or so, Cindy, it seems like people have been more willing lately to talk about things like depression and anxiety. Are you hoping that for schizophrenia and other causes and symptoms of psychosis that people are going to be willing and feel safe to talk about it?
Well, first, I have to like challenge the question in that, you know, part of my recovery is getting as much distance from those words. You know, mm-hmm. Part of my recovery is getting distance from the diagnosis of schizophrenia because that diagnosis comes with a horrible prognosis. You know, I was told, you know, you'll be on medication your whole life. You'll never be able to work. And I believed it for a while. Mm-hmm. And once I said, you know, maybe that's not true. You know, maybe it's trauma I need to heal, or maybe, you know, I have a spiritual experiences or I have gifts. So I had to change that framework to a framework that included recovery and hope and growth. Those particular frameworks do not hold much of that. And so they really kept me stuck.
Cindy, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your experience with us today.
Welcome.
That's Cindy Hatch, lead trainer at the Wildflower Alliance, a group that offers peer-to-peer support for people experiencing psychosis. For Wisconsinites interested in the resource, there is a Hearing Voices group in Madison. You can find a link to that group and to the Wildflower Alliance at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, it's Food Friday. We'll talk to the author of a new cookbook about how to use up all those leftover ingredients before they go bad. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.